On this episode of Newt's World, the issue of critical race theory has now taken hold in the United States military, and I have to say, I find it perplexing. My father served for 3 decades in the U.S. Army, and I grew up understanding that the military is about forming a bond, a unit, a team, working towards the same goals and protecting each other while achieving them. So you can imagine my shock when I started to learn how seriously the leaders at the Pentagon were starting to integrate critical race theory in their curriculums. In fact, a professor at the U.S. Air Force Academy, Lynn Chandler Garcia, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed, quote, "I teach critical race theories to our nation's future military leaders because it is vital that cadets understand the history of racism that has shaped both foreign and domestic policy." And as Mark Davis opined in Newsweek, quote, "Finding such warped content in today's liberal college classrooms is not surprising, but finding it at the U.S. Air Force Academy is unacceptable." I couldn't agree more. So I've invited to discuss critical race theory in the United States military a great guest, Dakota Wood. He served 2 decades in the United States Marine Corps, retiring as a lieutenant colonel, and he is currently the senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota Wood, thank you for joining me.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I wish we were talking about something more positive, right?
Yep, and something more designed to help America continue to be safe and to be the leading country in the world. As I understand it, and again, I didn't serve, but I watched my father for 27 years. When you're in a place and you're risking combat, small unit cohesion is really, really important. Somebody once said, people don't fight for some general theory. They fight for the person next to them. They fight for the sense of the integrity of the team. Isn't this whole current going after basically racist books? The Navy's professional reading program has books that portray America as systematically racist, argues that the Constitution was written just to perpetuate white supremacy. Isn't there a real danger that a military which begins to be divided by arguments about the nature of social power and the nature of whether you're black or white or brown, that it's almost the opposite of how you would like to grow a military?
It's the antithesis of everything I came to appreciate 20 years in the Marine Corps and now, you know, another 15 plus in a retired capacity, continue to work with the national security establishment. The antithesis of that, you're just spot on. It's small unit cohesion, trust among Marines or soldiers or airmen. If you're a crew on a ship and take a torpedo in the side and you've got a battle flames, who's giving orders to whom to go into congested spaces? If you have a lieutenant or a captain or a major or a first sergeant directing actions, do you want the junior personnel questioning that chain of command and the urgency of what might need to be done because the person issuing the order or to whom the order is being issued happens to be Latino or black or German or Filipino? I mean, is that where we're coming back to? Is looking at people by their skin color, their ethnicity, religious background. I mean, you recall the days when John F. Kennedy was coming into the presidency and there was questions about his Catholicism, right? Would that be the Vatican that's running things here in the United States instead of Washington, D.C.? So we've made such strides over the last 150 years plus at getting past all of that. And my experience as a young lieutenant, and we'll go back maybe 1987, 1988, and I had a motor transport platoon and an infantry battalion with the Marines here in Hawaii. And my maintenance chief was an American Samoan. My operations chief was a black American. The maintenance crew was Hispanic and white cowboy kids from Texas and New Jersey. I mean, it was just this wonderful mixture of Americans from city and rural, different ethnicities, different racial backgrounds, different religious convictions. And the whole idea of going through basic training through boot camp is you shed all of that You became a U.S. Marine, and because everybody advanced by merit, could you run a physical fitness test? Did you know how to fix the truck? Could you lay in a machine gun? I mean, these are all tasks. And if you could show that you were up to the task, people trusted you. So to your point, you know, both specified or explicit and implied, if you're wounded and you call for medical support, do you really care who the corpsman is coming up to render aid or a helicopter evacuation, who's piloting that aircraft? So this idea of segmenting our military and having Black Americans look at white Americans who might look at Asian Americans through this lens of race breaks everything apart when you look at that, and it will cause disaster on the battlefield.
I would think of the five services, counting the new Space Corps, that the Marines may be the unit most dedicated to cohesion and to the idea. I mean, I think of the extraordinary historic march from the Chosin Reservoir. You had to have a Marine Corps that had drilled into people so deeply that you don't leave people behind, that you work as a unit, etc., that I would think in many ways the Marines would be the most threatened by this kind of approach.
Any unit on the ground is going to do a fire plan. Where are your weapons? You have a defensible perimeter, even if you're postured for offensive action. And I'm just going to use this as a metaphor, that if you have individuals in fighting positions and you account for the weapon that they're carrying, they will have a left and a right lateral limit. You know, how far left should they train? How far right should they train? And if they focus in that area, then they're going to be very effective and they won't miss something. Well, the reason they can do that is that the next Marine to their right or left is also covering their area. So if you can't trust that your fellow Marine is doing what they're supposed to be doing, you can see how that whole system breaks down. And so this is an example of the broader community, that these small units going out have to trust that air support is going to be there, that the logistical resupply is going to occur, that the mechanics are going to show up to fix broken equipment. And if you have to start doubting that because some structure is in place that keeps the white guys in charge and the Black guys aren't going to account for anything, or if you're Hispanic and you speak with a funny accent, that somehow you're going to get less support. I mean, it just destroys cohesion, unity, trust, loyalty, the focus on mission. You're not so much concerned about mission because you're concerned about your own personal safety and security. I mean, it upends everything that we try to teach these young Americans coming into the military, regardless of service.
Do you know of any other country that's putting its military through something like this?
No, in fact, the opposite. I mean, if you look at some of the recruiting videos from Russia, it's just very manly, I'm going to defend hearth and home and go off to fight the enemies of Mother Russia. The Chinese are on record as becoming concerned about the feminization of Chinese males, that they're not manly enough. And I don't want to make this a man versus woman sort of thing, but the idea is that other countries want their militaries focused on the warfighting aspect of being in the military. That if you have to be concerned about the trustworthiness of those around you, or that you're not looking at warfighting competencies, then what the heck do you have a military for in the first place? You know, the Israelis, I mean, you know, it's a daily survival fight for them, so they can't get distracted by these sorts of things. And I think this is a consequence of the geographical kind of isolation of our country, where, you know, we're protected by big oceans, we don't have any problems with the Canadians, stuff coming up out of Mexico is more the drug trade, very unlike so many other countries in the world. And that since the end of the Cold War, we have had 30 years of incredible peace and prosperity here at home. So it's given us the luxury of getting distracted by all of these completely stupid sorts of things and losing focus on the core mission of the military, which is defending the country, and what is implied in terms of capabilities, cohesion, and identity within that military itself. When we start messing with that, I think the long-term viability of the country comes into question.
It strikes me that the whole process that we're now going through is a very, very high-risk gamble. Because, I mean, first of all, I think to myself, you're a Chinese or Russian analyst, and you're reading all this American stuff, and you're thinking to yourself, is this a military that I'm afraid of? Or is this a military that's just going to fall apart? And I think it has to lower our relative prestige, despite the fact that we have far and away the most advanced and most sophisticated and best-trained military in the world, that we're now going down a path that most of our competitors will think is literally unimaginable. I suspect they sit around and try to figure out, is this all actually kind of fake? Are the Americans trying to sell us on something that isn't true? Because I suspect for some of them, they're just going, nobody could be this dumb.
Yeah, you look at Afghanistan, going back to that. The Afghan National Army is four times the size of the Taliban. They're better equipped. They've had American advisory support for 18 or 19 years. They've got access to air support, all the things that the Taliban don't have. And yet you see them melting away on the battlefield, right? And so what this does is it punctures the idea that the Afghan military is credible and capable, and it emboldens the Taliban to be even more aggressive. So using that as an example, we go back to the United States. You know, nuclear deterrence hinges on the idea that others believe that we would actually use nuclear weapons if it pushed to that level. When you stop believing that America would actually willingly use these sorts of things, then the whole idea of deterrence falls apart. If we want other people on our team as opposed to China's, then these friends or partners have to believe that the United States is going to be there for them. If you're a competitor, like in Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, and to your point, start to believe that the United States really maybe isn't what we have made ourselves out to be in spite of the high-tech edge and all the cool equipment we bring to the field, if there isn't a trustworthiness within the military, then how would that military stand up in the struggles of high-intensity combat? So I think when we start calling into question these things, it harms our relationships with friends, which translates to trade relationships, which is quality of life and living and jobs and all those sorts of things back home. And it emboldens your competitors. You know, what is Russia doing in the Baltic Sea and in the Black Sea and in the Arctic? What is China doing in the South China Sea as it pushes into the Middle East and into Africa? So the more latitude they have, and the more of an idea that they have that the United States is breaking apart back at home, it amplifies these problems, and it causes more difficulties abroad when we should be doing the exact opposite of that.
You wrote about Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Lohmeyer, who was fired for criticizing critical race theory. What was your whole take on that incident, and why did they go after him so aggressively?
Because he was effective in getting his message out. You know, he was doing things on his own time. He self-published a book. He was on various talk shows. I listened to some of those podcasts. He was always very respectful of the chain of command. He tried to present a balanced argument about what is this critical race theory? What is it trying to convey? And then he would raise concerns that you and I are talking about, you know, how this could ultimately be damaging to the military that he had joined and was raised in. But this kind of criticism doesn't sit well with higher authorities if they have an agenda that they want to push forward, right? That if you have an agenda for combating climate change, for example, and you tell the military to account for this and everything it does, well, it might imply then that you need to spend more money on the military so that it's of sufficient capacity to deal with displaced people and larger storms coming across the horizon and maybe different forms of equipment. But here we have a mandate to account for combating climate change, and yet you don't see the funding that comes along with that. So I know that sounds as kind of a weird example, but now when you look at critical race theory, you have somebody down in the ranks saying, this doesn't make sense. What you're telling me doesn't match the organization that I'm seeing. My understanding of small unit leadership, of camaraderie, of mutual respect, doesn't comport with this divisive ideology of critical race theory and pitting one group against another. And so he raises these very compelling and credible arguments. And the command structure didn't like that. And so what is a natural reaction to dealing with a problem is you try to get rid of the problem instead of addressing the criticisms head on. In a way, it's kind of odd in that in the CRT world, somebody should be able to question the structures that somehow or other are keeping them enslaved or repressed or down. But when we have then criticism coming up that questions that whole anti-structural argument, the first thing they want to do is squash the person raising the criticism. I mean, talk about hypocritical. So it makes all the sense in the world, and it doesn't make any sense at all.
Have you been surprised by how aggressively the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, has defended this initiative?
I am. I mean, he comes from the Army, right? I mean, a very long career, so he knows this stuff. Then, you know, we're talking about calling things into question. Where is the senior military leadership at when, if you're the chief of naval operations, for example, and you put books on your professional reading list that carry forward these ideas? Now, you can have this excuse that, hey, I'm not saying that this is accurate. I'm really providing it for broader awareness of the various issues that America is dealing with. But you are sanctioning it in some way by saying that you think it's important enough for people to read and digest and understand. And so that carries some weight by virtue of the fact that the head of that service put it on a professional reading list. So in the same way, the Secretary of Defense defending this exposure to critical race theory as being something similar to, as we've heard from other general officers, studying Marxism or studying communism doesn't make you a Marxist or a communist. But I think they're missing the point that studying political ideologies of chief competitors so we know how to combat that is different than saying critical race theory, which has implicit in it, you know, the differences between the races and power structures. And yet when you call into question the whole argument, you're fired, right? So again, it's this kind of hypocritical thing. And I just don't understand how Secretary Austin or General Milley or Chief of Naval Operations Gilday can in good conscience say that all this is good.
Let me ask you, despite all of this, and as troubling as it is, if some young person came up to you and said, you spent all those years defending America, do you recommend that I go in despite all the confusion, or do you recommend that I skip joining the service because it's too confusing now?
I would still recommend joining. There aren't many things, I think, that are nobler than serving one's country. So we will never have a perfect country, a perfect military. I mean, half the commanding officers I worked for in the Marine Corps I thought were kind of jerks. They weren't bad people, but it was a leadership style that I didn't really care for that much. But I think the larger point is taking on challenges and putting yourself in service to the country that you love and respect and that you're trying to help grow. So we talk about military readiness or capacity, underfunding of defense, and we could talk for another hour about the sort of stuff that we write about all the time to try to measure. It makes then more important the people who are serving in the military. When so few are either eligible, I mean, 72% of American youth aren't even eligible to join the military because of criminal records, substance abuse, overweight, poor physical health, you know, a number of issues, they're not even eligible. So you're dealing then with 28% of those. How many are inclined to serve in the military, to serve their country, right? And so I wouldn't want to dissuade somebody or say now is not the time to join the military, because where does that leave the country? Completely undefended. So I think you wade into these battles, you roll up your sleeves, you hear all the mayhem that's kind of going on, but you say, I want to be a United States airman or soldier or marine or a space guardian and get to work. You know, I mean, serve the country, develop lifelong relationships, and somehow we're going to get past the CRT stuff, I'm convinced. You know, looking at moms and dads taking on school boards for trying to impose this sort of stuff in K through 12 education is nonsense. But the fact that there is this pushback, I think, is very heartening and it's very encouraging. And so, no, I would not argue against joining the military. I think it's more important now than ever.
My dad served briefly at the end of World War II, and then he served in Korea and Vietnam. I think that he looked back with a sense of great satisfaction that he was there when the country needed him and that he focused on doing a pretty complicated, difficult job. He was in the infantry. I think it was the most satisfying part of his life. When he did retire, he wasn't quite as clever as you at finding a job that kept your hand in and kept you thinking and kept you engaged. And I think he really missed it very deeply because it had been such a fulfilling part of his life.
Yeah, it breaks my heart when we see these defund the police movements and we see this resistance to law enforcement authorities on a domestic situation. If you were a serving police officer, what is your motivation to stay in when you're afraid of lawsuits or cameras everywhere and, you know, twisting of an event that might have occurred? And yet, what would happen with the country if all our police turned in their badges and hung up their uniforms? I mean, it would be chaos. So it makes me respect all the more those who continue to serve as police and firefighters and EMT technicians and all these other sorts of things. So it's a domestic example of the importance of deciding what you want to do to help better society, right? And get involved in things that can be very challenging. But what I have found is that relationships that are born in adversity are the longest lasting relationships. They're profound, life-changing, and you just never forget those moments when you were shoulder to shoulder with somebody, you know, like I was in Kuwait in 2003 and we pushed into Iraq. These are memories that you can't undo, and it helps frame your perspective of a bigger world that's out there larger than yourself and what things are important that need to be defended and promoted. I think it's just a wonderful life experience.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to thank you for having helped serve the country, helping protect the country, and continuing today to contribute to a very important professional thinking and critical thinking, not just about the issue we discussed on this podcast, but also I know that your work is across the board and that you have an impact on a remarkable range of issues. I want to thank you, Dakota. This has been fun, and as an Army brat, it has been a great enjoyment to engage a Marine and have this kind of conversation. And I thank you for joining us, and I thank you for serving the United States.
Thank you so much, and God bless, and please continue doing what you're doing.
Thank you to my guest, Dakota Wood. You can read more about critical race theory in the U.S. military on our show page at newtsworld.com. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.
Delay. We have gone through everything that we need to do. General Panaro, I'm going to stop talking and let you take over this show. Congratulations on your new book.
Just since 9/11, active duty military personnel have decreased by over 100,000 people, while the civilian government workforce in the Department of Defense has increased by 136,000 people. Cutting warfighters and adding bureaucrats does not strike fear into our adversaries. No matter where you look, this shrinking trend, as the budget has grown, has continued consistently through many administrations, both Democrat and Republican, and persists today. This extremely alarming trend is the result of what I call the ticking time bombs of national security. The Department of Defense is clearly not getting enough bang for the buck for the dollars it spends. Because of DOD's mammoth size, even marginal improvements and reforms can have an outsized impact. Therefore, anywhere the department can be more efficiently managed, improved, or streamlined, attempts must be made to do so on a continual basis. The ever-shrinking fighting force does not advocate reducing the defense budget top line, but rather urges the Pentagon and Congress to get more bang for the buck for the dollars they approve by reforming the bad processes. We should care more about outputs than inputs, and the Pentagon should measure those outputs with performance goals that that ensure DOD is better, faster, and cheaper than our adversaries, particularly China, whose purchasing power today is now greater than ours. China gets more bang for their yuan than the United States does for our dollars. Let me go through the ticking time bombs. One of them that contributes to the ever-shrinking fighting force is DOD's broken acquisition system that continues to cost more, take longer, and produce less. DOD does not employ successful business practices and processes when it comes to its huge expenditures for goods and services, supplies, and equipment. Despite the fact that American industry has proven conclusively that significant savings are possible in providing the needing cutting-edge technologies. In total, the current federal procurement data indicates that DOD is spending about $320 billion a year on goods and services, supplies, and equipment, a total sum that measures more than all the other government agencies combined and consumes over 8% of the total federal budget, with the unimpressive result of spend more, take longer, get less. Despite these large expenditures, this bureaucratic system now takes over 20 years from contract award to operational capability for combat aircraft and other major weapons, despite the fact that entire process used to only take 5 years, which, by the way, is China's current timeline for what they're producing. In the last 5 years, China has produced 105 ships in that same period of time the U.S. produced 26. Compare these timelines to the commercial world, where it takes less than 6 years to produce a new aircraft and less than 3 years to produce a new ground vehicle. Both the unit cost and the life cycle cost of modern weapons are also off the charts. In Desert Shield and Desert Storm, the Air Force active and reserve components had 4,468 fighters. Today, the Air Force has 2,141, down 50%. The Navy had 573 battle force ships at the peak of the Reagan buildup. Today we have 293, down 45%. The unit cost of the newer weapons have increased by hundreds of percentages over the ones they are replacing, and additionally, their life cycle costs are now over 50% higher than the earlier models. DOD's acquisition process are hampered by long-standing negative factors, including gold-plated requirements that are frequently changed and in many cases are unrealistic from both a technical and a cost standpoint. I have said, tongue-in-cheek, that if DOD could somehow get someone to support it, they would want a nuclear-powered tank that could fly itself to the battlefield. DOD also consistently fails to meet schedules, performance goals, and planned quantities that they wanted to purchase. They're plagued by significant cost overruns, not in the tens of millions, but in the billions. And there is inconsistent management and poor accountability. In addition, the acquisition process is suffering under massive layers of bureaucracy, as well as layers of rules and regulations. There are over 175,000 people working in the acquisition workforce, and the stack of rules, regulations, directives, and don'ts number in the tens of thousands of pages. While the acquisition leaders in both the Obama and Trump administrations, including Ash Carter, Frank Kendall, Ellen Ward, and others, attacked these problems and implemented positive change, it's not how far we've come. We've come this far. It's how far we still need to go. There's much more work to be done here. We also need to focus on the emerging technologies that are key for our country's economy, not just defense. This includes microelectronics, artificial intelligence, 5G, hypersonics, and autonomy, just to name a few. Our acquisition system must adapt to become more agile to keep up with these emerging technologies and to include companies that are highly competitive in the commercial space. Another ticking time bomb is the excessive amount of money tied up in DOD's massive, layered, and inefficient overhead and support functions. Here, we are spending more and getting more, which is exactly the opposite of the needed outcome. According to DOD's FY20 Defense Manpower Requirements Report, DOD's support functions represent 43% of its total workforce. When this ratio is applied to the total annual DOD budgets, these costs total over $309 billion. If they represented a gross domestic product, it would be one of the largest in the world. DOD says defense-wide spending has grown from 5% of the budget to just under 20% of the budget, but I believe that's underestimated, and I can document that the all-in costs are much closer to 30%. If you include all military personnel, civilian, and estimated contractors, there are over 902,000 people working in the DoD headquarters and agencies, joint staff, combatant commands, and service headquarters and field activities. The directly related cost for these organizations exceeds $137 billion. And by the way, DoD does a poor job keeping track of and controlling their headquarters number. From the original 45 people, as described by Secretary Forrestal when he assumed office in 1947, the OSD staff has increased approximately 100 times. DoD has added undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, and now has over 60 deputy assistant secretaries positions. The OSD staff today, when you include full-time reservists, detail, and contractors, is actually well over 500,000 people, though they advertise it as only 2,500 people. And by the way, the 5,000 number does not include the Pentagon IG, Washington Headquarters Services, and the Pentagon Force Protection Agency. The same uncontrolled growth has occurred in the Joint Staff. Today, the Joint Staff, when including the separately reported Office of the Chairman, numbers nearly 5,000 military civilians and contractors since 1958. The size of the Joint Staff has increased by a factor of 10. When Secretary Gates established the Joint Forces Command in 2010, a recommendation I actually made from the Defense Business Board, the military assigned to Joint Forces Command, over 2,000 people were reassigned to the Joint Staff. This is one of the reasons there's no accurate headcount. When one agency is dissolved, another organization is created to absorb the shock. This trend of uncontrollable growth is also present in the defense agencies, where we've gone from one defense agency in 1952 to 28 defense agencies in 2021, with 170,000 people, not including the tens of thousands of contractors, spending in excess of $120 billion. Many of these defense agencies are large business entities that would rank higher than the largest for-profit contractors in terms of how much business these defense agencies conduct with DoD, yet most do not incorporate applicable world-class business practices. Regarding defense facilities, DoD maintains one of the largest property books in the world, well over $880 billion worth, over 562,000 facilities, on more than 4,800 sites in all 50 states, 7 U.S. territories, and 40 foreign countries. The annual cost to operate and maintain these facilities is estimated at over $30 billion a year, but we know there is a significant room for saving. For example, DoD has consistently estimated that up to 20% of its facilities are excess, but neither DoD nor the Congress has exhibited the political will to make any major improvements here. McKinsey has actually been a real leader over the years, with many reports and articles on how to cut the tail and increase the tooth, something that I am also advocating throughout my career and highlight in the book, The Ever-Shrinking Fighting Force. A third ticking time bomb is the fully burdened and lifetime cost of the volunteer force, with its outdated personnel management, compensation, and retirement programs. What makes the lifetime personnel cost particularly worrisome is the department has no idea of what they really are, because they do not calculate or track the fully burdened and lifetime cost of active military reserve or full-time civilians. They just basically look at their annual pay. They don't look at the fully burdened cost. In the last 20 years, the average fully burdened cost for a mid-career individual on active duty has gone from $80,000 a year to the current estimate of close to $400,000 per year today. Factors contributing to the fully burdened cost are the support structures we provide to service members and their families, such as the cost to recruit them and provide skill training, the military health program that's gone from $17 billion to $52 billion a year, a taxpayer-subsidized grocery chain, military-dependent schools, a child care system, housing, and much more. Even more concerning, the data points exclude over $58 billion in retirement payments to military retirees and their survivors, paid each year by the Department of the Treasury. Today, we have 2.3 million retirees, military retirees, compared to the 1.3 million troops on active duty, and this gap is widening every year and soaking up, as I said, huge amounts of percentage of the DoD's $52 billion healthcare costs. There are 10 million beneficiaries of that healthcare system, of which 5.6 million are retirees and their dependents, using about 65% of that total cost. Further complicating the The problem is DOD's antiquated military pay system, which is based on time and grade and longevity versus skills and performance, something the creators of the all-volunteer force in 1973 recommended implementing. The department retains a pre-all-volunteer force military retirement system established when life expectancy was 66, when today for retirees it's 84 years. The system encourages our military to leave after 20 years, even though this is when they are most productive and experienced, and then pays them, their families, and their survivors for another 40 years. During this 40-year period, they receive benefits, including a monthly salary with annual cost of living increases, full health care, and other taxpayer-funded benefits. All in all, we pay them for 60 years to serve for 20 years while not even maximizing their full potential. The Government Accountability Office has questioned whether the, quote, increasingly costly military compensation system would be affordable, sustainable, and physically sound over the long term, end quote, concluding that it is, quote, unlikely, end quote. Unlikely. Based on all the analysis I've seen, coupled with my personal experience and the views of several recent Secretary of Defenses, I reluctantly agree with GAO's assessment. It is not sustainable over the long term. We'll never be able to adequately repay our service members and their families for the continual sacrifices they make on behalf of our country. However, in order to ensure that the all-volunteer force remains viable, DOD must ensure that military pay, benefits, and support are executed in a way that is sustainable for years to come. Senator Talent led a study at the Bipartisan Policy Center with numerous recommendations on how to improve the all-volunteer force in addressing these challenging problems. So there are roadmaps out there available for solving a lot of these ticking time bombs. The fourth ticking time bomb, and the last one I'll cover today, is the reality that we can't build a strong defense on a weak economy. As my dad used to say, quote, when your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep will be your downfall, end quote. Though not a direct cause of the ever-shrinking fighting force, our uncontrolled $23 trillion deficit and the $300 billion a year we are paying annually as interest on that debt are a threat to our national security as the deficit continues to put downward pressure on all discretionary spending, of which defense is the largest share. Most experts agree we need to get the deficit back under 4% of GDP as soon as possible from the 10% of GDP it is today. This is an issue that requires the efforts of Congress, the executive branch, and another Simpson-Bowles commission. Everything has to be on the table: discretionary spending, entitlements, the number one cause of deficit, and revenue. All of these problems and more are outlined in further detail in my new book, The Ever-Shrinking Fighting Force, along with suggestions for some much-needed reforms. Moving forward, we must demand that our leaders tackle these problems head-on, and we must hold them accountable for the results. The future of our national security depends on it. Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us here today.